be really short about this because we've got a great speech coming up, and I want y'all to have the maximum time to ask questions and listen. But a few short things about Dr. Friedman. He graduated from Harvard University and got his bachelor's degree in chemistry and physics, only to, in the future, get his master's and PhD in theoretical physics from Chicago University. Then he decided to become an academic economist and wrote maybe one of the most famous books in the Liberty Movement, The Machinery of Freedom, Guide to a Radical Capitalism, in 1973. He now teaches courses at Santa Clara University, among them Economic Analysis of Law. So please give a very warm welcome to Dr. David Friedman.
All right. So the subject today is, what is economics and why it isn't boring? And a lot of people think of economics as the study of the economy, as things like unemployment and inflation and stuff like that. Whereas a lot of economists think of economics as a way of understanding behavior and a way that can be applied to almost everything. I'll be running through applications to warfare, politics, sex and marriage, and law today, and there are lots of others that I could be discussing. What's the defining characteristic of economics from my standpoint? This thing is too high. The defining characteristic of economics is the assumption that individuals have objectives and tend to take the actions that achieve those objectives. That's what economists call rationality. It doesn't assume that you are rational by logical thought, that a lot of rationality is trial and error, a lot of rationality comes about in other ways. I have not actually analyzed how to get between my home and my office, but I've done it enough times so I have a pretty clear idea of which ways get me there fastest. I like to claim that not only are adult humans rational, babies and cats are rational too. If you imagine, I suppose some people in this room must have been a baby at some point in their lives. And if you imagine yourself as a small baby, you have only one tool with which to influence the world, and that's your voice. And so when you are wet or hungry, you make loud, unpleasant noises, and big people come and fix the problem. And given your very limited tools, that is, in fact, the rational thing to do. It is the action that best achieves your objectives. I don't know if any of you have ever had cats as a roommate, but if you happen to be living with a cat and you are so unkind or foolish as to read the newspaper when you should be petting the cat solves the problem by lying down on the newspaper. Now, again, I don't think the cat has figured out what a newspaper is or why it works, but by trial and error, it is determined that this is the effective way of achieving his objectives. So rationality, I think, is a powerful way of making sense of the behavior of not only humans, but a good many other things. I like to argue that genes are rational, that if you think about the implications of evolution, the implication of evolution is that we are all as if designed for reproductive success. That is, we are the descendants of people who succeeded in reproducing. And you can think of that as imagining that the genes that are constructing our body are rationally figuring out how to build a body that will succeed in passing those genes down to future generations. So in that sense, you can think of genes as rational as well. Now, it's clear that it's not a perfect description of human behavior, that I am generally overweight, and yet I have observed that if there is a bowl of potato chips within arm's reach, it mysteriously empties itself. And I try to deal with this problem by not having bowls of potato chips within arm's reach, but it does, I think, suggest an example of imperfectly rational behavior. A good many years ago, when I was a faculty fellow at University of Chicago Law School, I, for some reason, commented to my colleague, Judge Posner, that I had not paid for a parking space that summer at the law school, because if I didn't have a parking space, I was more likely to ride my bike in, since it made it less convenient to drive, and I thought I needed the exercise. And his reply was, but you're an economist, you believe in rational behavior, so shouldn't you be able to make the decision between driving and riding a bike without having to rig the game by making it less convenient to drive? And my reply was, rationality is an assumption about other people. I know myself well enough to fine-tune, well enough to figure out ways of allowing for my imperfect rationality, but I don't know the rest of the world that well. And that rationality is, in effect, the consistent pattern in human behavior. For anybody who is really interested, there's a very interesting book, Trying to Create a Theory of Mistakes, by a man called Kahneman, called Thinking Fast and Slow. And Kahneman is a psychologist who won a Nobel Prize in economics, and I think deserved it. So if you want some good intellectual reading, that's worth doing. But until we do a good deal more in that direction, I think we can't very well predict the non-rational behavior of people other than ourselves. We can predict the rational behavior, and therefore economics goes on that part. Let me go on to one of my favorite examples, which is the economics of warfare. And I want you to imagine that it's about 1,000 years ago, and we're somewhere in medieval Europe, and you are one of a line of 10,000 men with spears. And the spears are pointing that way. And the reason the spears are pointing that way is that in that direction, there are another 10,000 men on horseback, and they have spears too, and they're coming at you. And you do a very quick cost-benefit calculation. And you say to yourself, if we all stand and keep our spears braced, with luck we can stop their charge. And some of us will die, but most of us will live. If we run, horses run faster than we do. I should say. I'm sorry I made a mistake. I said we. I don't control him and him. If everybody else stands and I run, the odds of breaking the charge are almost as good because there are 10,000 of us. I'm only one guy in the line. And I won't be one of the ones killed. If everybody else runs and I stand, I'm dead. Whatever the other people are going to do, I'm better off running than standing. Everybody makes that calculation. We all run and most of us die. Welcome to the dark side of rationality. This is an example of what economists refer to as market failure, situations where individual rationality does not produce group rationality. And one of the very interesting questions, though not the one I'm talking about today, is under what circumstances that happens, how you can engineer around it to try to set up your organization or your institution so that individual rationality does produce group rationality. But typically it happens when my action produces a benefit for me but costs for other people. I ignore those costs. Total costs larger than total benefits. We're all worse off as a result, but each person is correctly calculating the effect on him of his action. So that's why armies run away. Let me give you the modern version of that. And the modern version, I want you to imagine that you're in a foxhole. This is probably around World War II or maybe Korea. And you've got a rifle. And what you're supposed to be doing is watching to see if anybody on the other side is visible and then shooting them. And there is a small problem with this. That in order to do this, you've got to have your head up, in which case somebody else might notice that you're there and shoot you. So what you do instead is bang, 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 such that it's not obvious to your officer that you're not aiming, but you're much less likely to get killed. Does anybody know what the ratio is of bullets fired to people killed in modern warfare? Much larger than 1,000 to 1. More like 10 or 100,000 to 1. And that's, I've just explained why that happens, at least given a partial explanation of why that happens. So again, that's rational behavior given the circumstances. There is a conflict of interest between the army and the soldier. Both of them want the army to win. Both of them want the soldier to survive the battle. But they have somewhat different priorities between those two. And so the soldier acting on his priority does not do what the general tells him to do acting on his. So that's a fairly simple example. It's the kind of problem economists refer to as a public good problem or an externality problem, just like the problems with air pollution. Namely, that my action in this case imposes a cost on me for a benefit for the army, and I get only a small share of that benefit, all of the cost, and therefore choose not to do it. Let me go on to the economics of politics. There is what I think of as the civics class model of a democracy. And the civics class model of democracy is that the politicians have to do the right things, because otherwise we'll vote them out. And the trouble with that model is that at least in a reasonably complicated polity like ours, figuring out whether the politicians are doing the right things is a non-trivial matter.
indeed, even figuring out what they're doing is a non-trivial matter. It's a very complicated system. For some reason, nobody, not even Trump, runs with the slogan, "I'm the bad guy." And as far as I know, no congressman has ever introduced a bill into Congress titled, "A Bill to Make Farmers Richer and City Folks Poorer." There is, in fact, such a bill introduced every year. It's called the Farm Program. The details vary, but typically the Farm Program is designed to force up the price of agricultural products, which is a benefit for farmers and a cost for everybody else. The Biofuels Program is designed to force up the price of agricultural products. It's the main contribution of the United States to world hunger, is to make corn much more expensive by turning half of it into alcohol. Half of the U.S. output, and the U.S. is the biggest producer of corn in the world. So that means that in order for the civic class model to work, the individual voters have to put a lot of time and energy and effort into following what the government is doing, into figuring out what bills their congressional candidate voted for if he was in Congress, which bills are good or bad, whether they should be for or against the Pacific trade policy or whatever else the people are arguing about. What's the incentive to get all this information? Well, the incentive is that if I do a good job, then when I vote for president, I will increase the chance that the good guy wins. How much will I increase the chance that the good guy wins? Well, very roughly by 1 in 10 million. All right. So the payoff to me of a 1 in 10 millionth chance of getting the better president is not enough to be an incentive for me to spend much effort figuring out who the good guy is. And it makes much more sense for me to figure out who is the candidate who my friends and neighbors like, because I'll be more popular with them if I'm wearing the right button or have the right bumper stickers on my car. Maybe who's the candidate who makes me feel good about supporting him, which probably means, you know, the one who looks handsome or the one who's a good demagogue or things of that sort. But it makes very little sense for individuals to behave in the way that the civics class model of democracy assumes. And this is a pattern which people in the field refer to as rational ignorance. It is rational to be ignorant when the information costs you more than it's worth. And this is different. The normal marketplace situation, if I decide which car to buy or which cell phone to buy, I'm the one who gets that car or cell phone, so I have an incentive to gather information about it. I have a very, very much weaker incentive when I'm choosing political candidates. Well, if the civic class model is wrong, is there a better model of democracy? And I think there is. And it's the model that I think of as the market for legislation. Let me go back to the idea of the public good problem, which is a standard economic idea. Public good is a good such that if it's produced, the producer can't control who gets it. All right, a radio broadcast would be a standard example of a public good. And the problem with the public good problem is that ordinary private goods, I produce it. If it's worth money to you, you're willing to pay me to get it. The amount people are willing to pay for it is a measure of the value to the customers of the good. What it costs me to produce it is a measure of the cost of the inputs that I'm using to produce it, the amount of human labor that's required, and so forth. If what it's worth for the customers is greater than what it costs me to produce, then it's worth producing. It's privately worth producing. I can make money producing it. And it's socially worth producing in that the society is better off when you produce things that are worth more than they cost. Very simple argument. It doesn't work for public goods, because for the public good, the producer can't control who gets it. I therefore can't say you don't get it unless you pay me. And you end up with much clumsier ways of trying to produce public goods. Some public goods get produced, I should say. One of the ways of doing it is the public is very small. If you're talking about 8 people living along a street, and the question is, are we going to paint our houses so they'll all look nice? It's not that difficult for 8 people to get together and say, look, I'll do it if you do it, and thus, by some sort of bargaining, produce the public good. But those mechanisms get harder and harder the larger the public is. Now, think about special interest legislation. Think about a law such as a tariff, a tax on importing cars. A tax on importing cars is a good thing if you're a stockholder of an American car company. It's a good thing if you work in Detroit in an American car company. It's a bad thing if you are somebody who buys a car, because you're going to be paying a higher price as a result. And it's also a bad thing if you produce export goods, if you're an American farmer, for example, because the fewer cars we import, the fewer wheat we're going to export. After all, if the Japanese get our dollars for selling their cars, they can't eat the dollars, so they end up ultimately using the dollars to buy something in the U.S. So you've got to change a tariff which benefits some people and harms other people. It's a public good from the standpoint of both groups. From the standpoint of the people who are benefited, they've got a public good problem of raising the money to bribe congressmen to pass the tariff. And from the standpoint of the people who are injured by the tariff, they have the public good problem of raising the money to bribe politicians to defeat the tariff. Simple way of looking at that. The difference is that the beneficiaries of the tariff are a small and fairly well-organized group. They are represented by the United Auto Workers, by the presidents of the small number of U.S. car companies, and that's a small enough, concentrated enough interest group so that if their benefit from the tariff is, say, $10 billion a year, they can probably raise at least something in the hundreds of millions to buy the votes necessary to get the tariff. The victims are a very large and dispersed interest group, roughly 250 million, 290 million people. There is no practical way for them to get together and fund the opposition. So the general pattern, if you look at the market for legislation, is that the political market reflects benefits and costs just like the private market, but it weights them very unevenly according to whether the groups helped or hurt are concentrated or dispersed interest groups. That the interest of a concentrated, organized interest group like the auto industry gets much more heavily weighted than the interest of a dispersed interest group such as customers of the auto industry. So you would expect, and what you observe, is that a lot of legislation consists of laws designed to transfer income from dispersed interest groups to concentrated interest groups. Tariffs are an interesting case. The economics of tariffs was worked out just about 200 years ago by David Ricardo, probably the first great economic theorist who existed, something called the theory of comparative advantage. It is harder to understand than the incorrect theory that preceded it, which is why most discussions of trade policy are still 200 years out of date. But the interesting fact is that one of the implications of the correct theory is that imposing a tariff usually hurts the country that imposes it, that the American citizens as a whole are almost always worse off if they put on a tariff than if they don't. There are some special cases where this is true, but they're not very common. And yet, from the time Ricardo worked it out to the present, almost every country has had tariffs. There are a couple of exceptions, and they're interesting exceptions. The two great exceptions are England in the 19th century and Hong Kong, which wasn't a country but was a British colony, in the 20th century. And they happen to be two of the great economic success stories of history. England in the 19th century was, until overtaken by the U.S., the leading economy in the world. Hong Kong went from a dirt-poor country with 10 times the population density of the most densely populated country in the world, which was Singapore at the time, with refugees coming in from China with nothing, to the point at which a couple of decades ago, per capita income of Hong Kong passed that of England. Right, so those are very striking cases. Now, there are other differences besides free trade, but there are cases where such evidence we have strongly supports what the theory tells us, namely that imposing a tariff is shooting yourself in the foot, that tariff negotiations consist of my saying, I'll stop shooting myself in the foot if you stop shooting yourself in the foot, which seems a very odd thing to argue about. But it makes perfectly good sense if you realize the negotiations are not by the population of the United States, they're by politicians who want to get elected and who want campaign contributions, and imposing a tariff is a loss for the welfare of the population of the United States, but it's a gain for the politicians who pass it, because the gainers are a concentrated interest group and the losers the dispersed interest group, and therefore it is politically profitable. So it makes perfectly good sense that an American politician says to a Japanese politician, I'd like to keep our tariffs. I'm willing to drop them, though, if you'll drop yours, because that's also popular with my voters, so maybe we can bargain. It's really quite a striking example where the economics explains the pattern of what we actually observe. Market for legislation. Let me go on to talk about a subject that is, of course, of no interest to any of you, namely
Oops. There we are. No, ah, sorry, I got one more before that. I misread my own outline. Sorry. The third point, people often talk about firms only being interested in the bottom line in the short run, and we need the government to make sure we take account of long-run effects. And the truth is exactly the opposite. And the question is, how do you make it in people's interest to plan for the long term? Imagine that you're thinking about planting black walnut trees. Black walnut is a valuable timber, but it doesn't grow very fast. And suppose I'm 70 years old, and I'm considering planting the land I own to black walnuts, and it'll be 40 years before they're at the optimal size to harvest. And you might say, it clearly doesn't pay me to do it, because I'm going to be dead by the time I grow. But that's not right, because 10 years from now, I can sell my 10-year-old black walnut forest to somebody else who knows that he'll only have to wait 30 years instead of 40 years. If he wants, he can sell it to somebody else in another 10 years, which means that it is in my selfish interest to take account of the crop that's going to be harvested 20 years after I die. All right, it's my selfish interest because that value is passed back to me because I can sell what I own to somebody who will still be around, or whose successors will still be around. In order for that to work, however, we need secure property rights. If I believe that each year there is a 10% chance that some wicked person will drive onto my land at night with a chainsaw and carry off my partly grown black walnut trees, which are still big enough to be worth something, or if I believe that each year there's a 5% chance that the government will decide that black walnut trees are a national resource and nationalize them and seize them, then it wouldn't pay me to plant those trees unless it was so profitable that it made up for all of those risks. So what that's suggesting is that what you need for long-term planning are secure property rights. You need to be reasonably sure that what you own today will tomorrow belong either to you or to somebody who you have transferred it to. Politicians in a democratic system have very insecure property rights. That, as I used to put it a few presidents ago, Clinton could rent out the White House, but he couldn't sell it. If you are the mayor of Sao Paulo in Brazil, and the question is, should you spend money repairing the water system, which is eventually going to break down, but not for another decade or so, or should you spend that money on benefits for voters who will vote for you in the next election, you will reasonably enough say, by the time it breaks down, somebody else is going to be in power. He'll get blamed when it breaks down. I won't. On the other hand, if I spend money on voters now, I'll get reelected. So in general, if you think about how the political system works, the politicians talk a lot about long-term benefits. But what they're actually looking at is what will be the unemployment rate at the next election, what will be the inflation rate at the next election. And they're perfectly rational to act in that way because they don't have secure property rights in their political assets, and therefore know that long-term planning for nation are going to be the same. Why do they talk about long-term things? Because the great thing about the future is you can't see it. And therefore, if you're unpopular, you can say the reason we're doing these things you don't like is so that your children or your grandchildren will be well off. And the great proponent of this tactic, of course, was Joseph Stalin, that he couldn't tell the Russian people, you're well off, because they were living in Moscow, a family to a room. They were in long lines to get stuff. But he could, for a while, tell them, yes, it's true, we're all suffering, at least you're all suffering. But the reason is that we've got to invest in building up our industry to catch up with the capitalists. And in another 20 years, we'll be richer than the Americans. And these are the sacrifices we're making until that time. And that works for a while. It eventually doesn't work because time passes and people become less and less willing to believe this story. But it makes a whole lot of sense. You know, Lewis Carroll has it as jam yesterday and jam tomorrow, but never jam today. It makes a lot of sense if you are doing things that really have bad effects to pretend good effects in the distant future, since the people can see the bad effects but can't see whether the good effects are there or not. So that's my short time horizons. One of the disadvantages of the political system over the ordinary market, or the political market over the private market, is that. Let me now go on to a subject, of course, of no interest to any of you. assuming that this thing works. There we go. Economics of sex and marriage.
This is a market that we're all involved in one form or another. And it's a very odd market. That if you want a car, you go to the car company and buy a car. If you want groceries, you go to the grocery store and get groceries. If you want a girlfriend or a lover or a wife, I don't know where the girlfriend, lover, wife store is. And it's a market where you spend a lot of time, a lot of frustrated people, a lot of time and effort in search. Why is this? From an economist standpoint, why is it so hard to match people? And the answer is that, as economists observed a long time ago, barter markets don't work very well. What's the difference? The normal market, if I want a car, all I have to do is to go to a car company and give them some money. I don't have to find a car company that wants to buy economists. All right? A barter market is one where you're trading what you've got for what they've got. It's much harder to make a barter transaction because you need what we refer to as the double coincidence of wants. You need somebody who has what you want and wants what you have. All right, but the dating, sex, marriage market is inherently a barter market. If I'm married to you, you're married to me. If I'm sleeping with you, you're sleeping with me. So that means that in order to make that market work, you have to solve the double coincidence of wants. You have to find somebody who not only is the person you really want, but by some odd, unlikely chance is the person who really wants you. And as probably some of you have experienced, that's not a trivial problem to solve. But it's a very important problem to solve. So that's the first point that I wanted to make about the economics of that particular market, the double coincidence problem. Second thing about that market is that one of the interesting things about it is that traditionally it was a market that existed largely through long-term contracts. The long-term contract is called marriage. It's not the only form, obviously, in which people engaged in love, sex, and the rest of it, but traditionally it's been the major form for that. And so that gets you into thinking about why do people have long-term contracts? Why not? Why don't we do everything in the world as a spot contract? It's just a transaction day by day. Which, of course, some of those things now we do that way. Probably doesn't work that well. So I like to tell the story by considering when I went to UCLA as an assistant professor. And from my standpoint, at the point when UCLA hired me, they could have hired any of a lot of other people. It was a competitive market. At the point when I went to UCLA, I could have gone to other universities. Other universities wanted me. That's a competitive market. But once I'm there, to some extent, we're both locked in. I've borne the cost of finding a house to stay in, moving my property across the country, learning a new set of colleagues, figuring out how to teach students at UCLA. They've borne a similar set of costs in adapting to me. And the result is that suppose I would have been willing to come for $50,000 a year and they were willing to pay me $50,000 a year. Let's imagine that was the original term. After I've been there a year or two, it occurs to the chairman of the department that they really could use some more money, and that if I was willing to come for $50,000, I'm probably willing to stay for $40,000, because I've already borne all of the sunk costs associated with becoming with moving across the country. And so the chairman calls me into his office to discuss the tight state of the department budget. Well, I'm happy to come into the office to discuss that, because it's occurred to me that the same situation is true in the other direction, that they had to bear various costs. First year or two, I couldn't do a very good job of teaching their students, so I didn't really know what it was. They couldn't interact with me as well because my colleagues didn't know me. By now, I've settled in. Everything's working smoothly. If they were willing to pay me $50,000 to come, they should be willing to pay me $60,000 to stay. So we now have a situation which has gone from a competitive market to what economists call a bilateral monopoly, one with one buyer and one seller, because on both ends, we've gotten locked into this contract by sunk costs. What we refer to as relationship-specific sunk costs. My costs born to become a professor at UCLA don't do me any good if I go back to BPI. All right. So the solution to that, and the usual solution in such terms, is you have either formally, legally, or by custom, long-term contracts where it's understood that they aren't really entitled to renegotiate down or not entitled to renegotiate up unless something substantial changes. Well, now think about marriage. All right, marriage, once you've been living with somebody, especially once you've produced some children, you both have borne quite large costs in learning to live with each other. For those of you who have not been married, I can tell you this is, my wife I'm remembering having lunch with some people who said they really wanted to meet my wife, not me, and wanted to know how somebody could learn to put up with me. These are people I knew online, a couple of authors, actually. And so you've born, but you've also got children who are a sunk cost, and you will find it very costly to dissolve that particular relationship. And it therefore makes a good deal of sense, whether by law or by custom, that you normally do marriage as a long-term contract rather than a short-term. So that's simply applying economics to making sense of that particular market. My general point, and hope is clear, is to try to give you some idea of how wide the range is of things to which economics applies. Let me go on to I should say, the next question that might occur to you is, why has it become a less long-term contract over my lifetime? Why is it that at this point, not only do a large fraction of marriages not last for a lifetime, but quite a lot of people live together without getting married? And the economist's answer is that there have been a couple of changes which have reduced the amount of sunk costs. That in particular, infant mortality has gone to almost zero, which means you only have to produce two children to have two children rather than six. That means that whereas it used to be that the wife was really specialized to the job of being the wife of this husband, that was something close to a full-time profession, the combination of lower infant mortality and the shift of a lot of household production out of the household, the fact that we have washing machines and electric stoves and TV dinners and freezers, means that what used to be a full-time profession, namely being a housewife, is now a part-time profession except for a fairly short period of time when you're bringing up small children. That means you're less specialized to each other. That means that you would expect, not that there still aren't real reasons for long-term contracts, they still make a lot of sense, but that the reasons are weaker, and you would therefore expect things to become somewhat less stable. Let me go on to a couple of other bits, which both of which come out of articles done by people other than me, but articles I like. And one of them is an article by Margaret Brinig called Rings and Promises, which deals with the question of the custom of giving engagements. And people think of this as an ancient custom, but in fact it turns out that the giving of expensive engagement rings only arises in the U.S., I think some point around the 1920s or 1930s. It's going away at this point. And Peggy Brinig thinks she knows why. Because there used to be a legal rule. Well, let me go back a second. Every generation thinks they invented sex, despite the fact that their existence is evidence to the contrary. Every generation at least thinks they invented premarital sex, but that's also mistaken. There is some evidence by looking at marriage versus date of birth of the first child, suggesting that in a number of European cities in the late 19th century, about a third of all brides were pregnant. That is, they had their first child less than 9 months after they were married. The traditional system was one in which it was common for courting couples to sleep together, but with the understanding that if the woman got pregnant, the man would marry her. And there were not only customs, but legal rules to enforce this. Because a breach of promise suit was a suit for damages. And theoretically, it was a suit for damages for promising to marry somebody and not doing it. A economist would say it was a suit for damages for loss of virginity. Because on the marriage market prior to the last few decades, virginity was a very important asset. If you look, for example, the traditional Jewish law, the amount of money that a man has to put up, which will forfeit if he divorces his wife, is twice as high if he marries a virgin than if he marries a non-virgin. You see this in stuff from 1,000 years ago. So that was the legal rule in the U.S., was that you could sue for breach of promise and collect damages, and that made the implicit or explicit contract that if she gets pregnant, they'll get married a pretty much enforceable contract. Over a period of time around the 1930s, one state after another abolished the action for breach of contract. Well, what do you do if you can't enforce a contract? You post a bond. So what happens instead is that there arises the custom that the man in one of these relationships, when he gets engaged and promises to marry the woman, gives her an expensive ring, which she can keep if he jilts her. So, in effect, the diamond engagement ring, so Brinig argues, I think very possibly correctly, that custom arose as a way of replacing the legal rule for enforcing the agreement. And in fact, she has data on diamond sales, which fit pretty neatly the pattern that they start going up as more states abandon this rule. They go down in the modern time because virginity is no longer important on the marriage market. Under current customs, first we've got good contraceptives and abortion, but even aside from that, the fact that a woman gets pregnant certainly can have significant negative effects, but nothing like the negative effects it could have had 100 years ago. Okay?
So that's a sort of a neat bit of applying the economics approach to marriage. Finally, let's go to one of the problems of the present situation.
And this is an article by another friend of mine, by Lloyd Cohen, which he called I gave him the best years of my life. And that's supposed to be about a long-term contract in which performance is out of sync. You've got two firms. They're engaged in a joint project. One of them is going to bear large costs early for its half of the project, and the other large costs later for its half, and then they split the returns. All right? There's a problem there. And the problem is that it is in the interest of the firm that performs second to try to back out of the contract when the other party is performed before it's borne any costs. It then gets the benefit and none of the costs. Now think about a traditional marriage. In a traditional marriage, the early part is when you are producing children, which is the most costly activity that the wife is the main producer of, both biologically costly and bringing up, for those of you who haven't done it, bringing up small children can be very rewarding, but it's also an awful lot of work. All right. After we had my present wife and I had our daughter, I concluded that no family had more than two children. There just wasn't enough time. And that the families that pretended to have more than two children must borrow the extra ones from the neighbors when they had to put them on display. But now after about, say, 15 or 20 years, the kids are in high school or maybe if you're lucky even in college, they're out of the house, the wife finally gets to catch her breath, play some bridge, be more or less a semi-retired person, having done the hard work of the first 20 years. Meanwhile, the husband, in the early years, he's early in his career, he's not making a lot of money, so they're not doing too well. But 20 years in, he's well established, he's got a nice high income. So why should he continue to split that income with the wife? He's no longer contributing to the family. So that means if you don't have enforceable contracts, we just say if you have easy divorce, there's a temptation for the husband to dump the wife at that point, go marry a younger and sexier woman, and replace her. Trophy bride, as they like to put it. And so Lloyd Cohen's argument is that this is a problem which arose as divorce became easy. Well, how do you deal with that problem? Women are rational people, just like men. And the answer is that if you know you're in this situation, you will try to shift the performance of the contract. You will try to do two things. First, if you know that your partner in the contract might dump you, you try to invest less in the relationship. You try to spend more resources getting a career that you can make a living at and few optimizing to be a housewife. And second, you start having children later, you spread out the childbearing over more time so that you are less vulnerable to the situation where you've performed and he hasn't performed. And indeed, the data suggests that those are the patterns that actually happen. So Lloyd has got this sort of neat argument that explains what we think of as social changes as the result of a legal change, easy divorce, plus economic behavior by people who are sometimes less scrupulous than they ought to be. He only made one mistake, and his mistake was a mistake of rhetoric, not of economics, that he described the situation as women depreciating faster than men on the marriage market. And that, for some reason, caused feminists at least to dislike his article, when they should have liked his article, which was, in fact, about the fact that women performed early and men performed late on the marriage contract. But it's a neat bit of economics nonetheless. That's contract default. Oh, one last thing, and this is my work, so that was sort of fun. The question is, what would be the effect on men and women of legalizing polygamy? More precisely, there are two common forms of polygamy. Polygyny is multiple wives. Polyandry is multiple husbands. The most common arrangement, of course, is monogamy in human societies, but polygyny is moderately common, polyandry pretty rare. So suppose you legalize polygyny, what's the effect on men and women? And most people assume the answer is that legalizing polygyny means men do well because they've got harems and women do badly. But of course that's forgetting the fact that legalizing polygyny doesn't mean a whole bunch of extra women come into existence, that in a society like ours you still have to get a woman's permission to marry her. And if you are trying to marry a woman as your second wife, you're going to have to offer her terms that are better than the terms somebody else offers her to be their first wife. Think about it in economic terms, and what happens when you have legalized polygyny is that the demand curve for wives shifts out. That everybody who wanted one wife still wants one wife, but some people also want a second wife and can try to purchase a second wife. How do you purchase? There are implicit terms to the contract. It's not a direct money payment in our system, though there are societies where it is. But there are terms of what's the division of labor, to what extent will we live where you want to live instead of where I want to live, a whole bunch of implicit terms of to what degree the arrangements of the marriage are biased towards one party or another. And the argument I'm offering is that the effect of legalizing polygyny is to shift up the price of a wife, that is to say, to shift the terms of the contract in favor of women, because the man who wants to marry one wife now has to bid not only against the other men who want to marry a first wife, but also against the men who want to marry a second. Legalizing polyandry would have the same effect in the opposite direction. It would bid up shift out the demand curve for husbands, and the result is that wives would now have to pay more for their husbands, meaning they would shift the terms in favor of the husbands. I'm running a little bit low on time. Let me run briefly through some of the... I was going to talk... I'm going to skip economics. Economist as philosopher. I'll do that later if those are the two questions. If there's time in the question period, but there probably isn't. So economics of law.
Suppose we have a legal system where the highest penalty is life imprisonment, and somebody says, should armed robbers get life imprisonment? And an economist says, you really want armed robbers to routinely kill their victims. Because after all, if the punishment for armed robbery and the punishment for armed robbery plus murder are the same, the additional punishment for the murder is zero, what we refer to as the marginal deterrence problem. And if you kill your victim, he can't identify you. And you're therefore less likely to get caught.
So that would be one very simple example of economics of law. Another example is the difference between the civil standard of proof, which is preponderance of the evidence, the criminal, which is beyond a reasonable doubt. Why does it make any sense to have that division? And the economist says it makes sense to have that division because criminal penalties usually impose a cost on one person without a benefit on anybody else. They have a net cost. When you hang somebody, nobody gets the life he loses. When you imprison somebody, nobody gets the freedom he loses, and someone has to pay for the prison. Civil penalties are usually a transfer of money, a damage payment. If you make a mistake in a civil penalty, well, I lose $1,000 I shouldn't. You gain $1,000 you shouldn't, not a serious problem. Whereas if you make mistakes in criminal penalties, sometimes you hang one guy who was innocent, sometimes you hang another guy who was innocent. No balancing benefit. So that makes some sense. Next question is, what's wrong with theft anyway, from the economist standpoint?
After all, somebody steals $100 from me, I'm $100 worse off, he's $100 better off, why is that a problem? And the economist's answer is that it's a problem because the opportunity to steal money diverts resources into stealing. Right? Imagine that picking pockets makes $20 an hour. Well, unless you've got a better job than that, you switch into picking pockets. And if that's substantially higher than the wage level, more and more people switch into picking pockets. They drive down the implicit wage because there are too many pickpockets, and therefore people don't carry money, and you pick somebody's pocket and it's empty because someone else beat you to it. So if you think about economics, competition drives the return from pickpocketing down to the normal wage level, at which point people are abandoning a $10 an hour job producing something for a $10 an hour job stealing, which produces nothing, and the society is poorer by $10 an hour.
This is what economists refer to as rent seeking, the situation where people are spending their resources not on producing things, but on transferring things, and then it's not the transfer that's a net cost, it's the expenditure of resources to do it. And one more, which I'm not going to talk about because I want to have a minute or two at least for questions, and that is, why do we have both civil and criminal law? That if you think about it, criminal law and tort law do the same thing in different forms. You do something bad, either the government arrests you or the victim sues you. Something bad happens to you, that's a reason not to do bad things. Why do we have these two mechanisms? And I don't have as much time as I'd like to, so therefore, let me point out that if you want more information of various sorts, here's a bunch of stuff of mine that you can find. Oops, I wasn't supposed to do that. Yeah. Not supposed to do that either. This is going to take a moment. Anyway, there's a bunch of my stuff, which is here, here, and books of mine that you might find useful. And I should have had more time for this than I did, but I didn't. Questions for the last 20 seconds or whatever we've got? Any questions?
Can you answer this?
Yes.
Can you elaborate on our monetary system?
Not in 20 seconds, I can't. I'm in favor of private competing banks with fractional reserve currency, but that would be a longer than the amount of time. What?
Independent currency?
Yes, right. Hopefully exchanging it one for one for convenience. Yeah.
If you were to recommend like some introductory reading to the Chicago School of Economics,
I'm prejudiced. My book, Hidden Order, is a price theory textbook rewritten to be a book for people reading it for fun. And that's an attempt to explain economics as I understand it. I don't find the sort of Chicago School, Austrian School disagreement all that exciting. My father's usual comment was, I'm an American economist. I think a lot of it is, well, I won't say unkind things, but, and it depends a lot on which Austrian it is, because there are some Austrians who are very reasonable people and some who aren't. But I think I'm out of time. So thank you all.
All right, one more round of applause for David Friedman.